and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at. Vietnam is celebrating 50 years since the end of the war with the U.S. We talk with local community members and veterans about their experiences.
Becoming and remaining a sanctuary city has been a bit of a mayoral tug of war.
With sanctuary cities in the spotlight again this week, we explain how Chicago got the designation and what it means. And a historic Chicago parade celebrating Mexican culture is canceled this year. Organizers tell us why. And now to some of today's top stories. The Trump administration has its first major staff shakeup of the president's second term. President Donald Trump took to social media saying he will be nominating National Security Advisor Mike Waltz to be the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. The move comes amid ongoing scrutiny after reports revealed Waltz added a journalist to a private text chain which was used to discuss a sensitive military operation in Yemen. But Democrats like Illinois Senator Tammy Duckworth says she hopes there's more shakeup ahead.
Well, it's long overdue. I mean, he's the guy who started the unclassified text chain when there were classified channels available. It's his responsibility, but I also think Pete Hegseth needs to be fired as well. After all, Mr. Hegseth is the person who put the classified information on that text chain, who then also shared that same classified information on a separate text chain involving his wife, for crying out loud.
Trump says Secretary of State Marco Rubio will serve as National Security Advisor in the interim. Demonstrators took to the streets today in Chicago and across the country to protest President Trump's policies. The rally and march is part of International Workers' Day, or what's known as May Day. Thousands marched from Union Park to Grant Park, where labor and immigrant advocates aired their concerns.
This administration wants to paint all immigrants as a threat to all of us, to our jobs, to our safety, to our neighborhoods, but we cannot stand for this. We are the immigrants. We are the neighbors. We are the workers.
Chicago is the site of the first ever May Day event back in 1886 when thousands of workers protested for an eight-hour workday. The historic Haymarket riot occurred 3 days later. The city of Chicago and actor Jussie Smollett may have reached a settlement in the civil suit the actor filed against the city. Attorneys for both told a federal judge that they'd reached an agreement in principle but are still working out some terms. Smollett was convicted of 5 counts of disorderly conduct back in 2021 after a special prosecutor charged him with faking a hate crime in 2019. But last year, the Illinois Supreme Court tossed those convictions, ruling that former Cook County State's Attorney Kim Fox's office had already resolved the case through a non-prosecution agreement. Smollett has consistently maintained his innocence. A high school, a cultural center, theater, and a Frank Lloyd Wright house are among the 10 most endangered historic places in the state. That's according to the group Landmarks Illinois, which released their annual list today. Chicago Vocational High School in the city's Avalon Park neighborhood is one of those 3 Chicago sites on the list. Landmarks Illinois says while the campus was built to serve 6,000 students, less than 900 are enrolled, and entire wings of the complex aren't in use and slated for demolition. The outdoor theater of the South Shore Cultural Center, shown here, is also in danger after deteriorating for years to the point of being unusable. And the J.J. Walzer House in Austin has been vacant since its most recent owner died in 2019. It's one of just a handful of Frank Lloyd Wright structures still standing in Chicago. Still to come, a local Cinco de Mayo parade is canceled over immigration enforcement fears. We speak with the festival organizers about their decision. But first, this week marks the 50th anniversary of the Vietnam War ending. We hear from members of the Vietnamese community and local veterans.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
This week marks the 50th anniversary of the end of the Vietnam War, which is also known as the Fall of Saigon. The conflict killed several million Vietnamese and 60,000 American service members. Vietnam marked the anniversary of the war's end with a parade to promote peace and unity. And Chicagoans are also commemorating the event. Joining us now to share their experiences are Roger McGill, a Vietnam veteran who served in the U.S. Army and a co-organizer for Chicago's 1986 Welcome Home Parade. Dale Tippett, a Vietnam veteran who served in the U.S. Navy and helped evacuate the city of Saigon as part of Operation Frequent Wind. Mung Wan, an evacuee who escaped from Vietnam. And Von Nguyen, executive director at the Vietnamese Association of Illinois. Thanks to all of you for joining us. Dale Tippett, let's start with you, please. What is Operation Frequent Wind, and what was your role in it?
Well, Operation Frequent Wind was the evacuation of South Vietnam. There was an armada of ships stationed off the coast of South Vietnam. The war had been deteriorating for many months. Orders had been put out there for us to get in position in the likely event that an evacuation would occur. And President Ford eventually, on April 29th, when things totally, you know, came apart with the North coming into Saigon, said start the evacuation. So we had, I don't even know how many ships there were out there. There was a bunch of us. And but it was a humanitarian mission. I never went ashore,
You were a cook aboard.
I was a cook
one of those
aboard.
Ships.
I was 18 years old. That was my first what we call the Westpac cruise. I was just excited about being out there, being part of the military, being part of the Navy. It's something I wanted to do, and this all just coincided with just that moment in history. So I had just gotten off work. A couple hours later, all of a sudden, the drills stopped being drills, and it became a real active operation. So I was on an amphibious cargo ship. We carried Marines and their light equipment. So we were what you would see as a typical cargo ship. That's what I was on, only they had a lot of space for cargo, but our cargo holds were empty, basically. And we started to bring on those evacuees, and we had cots and so forth set up for them.
Mung Wan, you were one of those evacuees. Tell us how you got out of Saigon.
I left the South Vietnam. Actually, I work in Saigon, but 2 days before 30th of April, I went to see my husband in the South because he said that they gone bomb at Saigon. So I left, and then I went to see my husband, and then the next day we left. From there, 30th of April, we left from there and got into the American ship waiting to rescue.
So one of the ships that Dale was talking about, you were evacuated in those, and your husband as well?
My husband and with my three kids.
And your three children.
Yeah.
You were married at the time. Your husband you were able to leave with your family. What was life like for you once you arrived to Chicago?
You know, that time I did not know, but this is the new life. Whatever we get, we work for it, and very lucky that we got to U.S.
And you now own a coffee shop in North Center.
Now I and have a coffee shop at my life for 20 years.
I'm sure Vietnamese coffee is probably your specialty.
Not Vietnamese coffee,
no. Okay.
American coffee.
American coffee.
Yeah.
I was hopeful. Roger, you saw hand-to-hand combat in Vietnam. What was it like for you returning to the United States after the war?
When I came home, it took me about 18 hours to get home from, we left Saigon by plane. And we flew all the way. We stopped in Japan, and then we flew nonstop to Oakland, California. We got off the plane. Everybody that got off the plane got down and kissed the ground. We were glad to be back home. And then about five of us were going to stay overnight and see San Francisco and stuff like that out there for a while. And there were four of us. We were in a hotel room. Pretty close to Oakland airfield, and we all fell asleep. We ate at a restaurant there, and we all fell asleep. We've been up for
two days,
and so one of the guys leaned his against the headboard, and within seconds, all four of us were on the ground in the room. And we all decided right then and there that we were going home. So the next morning came, went over to Oakland Airport, got on a flight, came home to Chicago. I came home, got in a cab. There was an African-American cab driver driving the cab, and he asked me, "Where are you coming from, soldier?" I said, "Vietnam." He said, "What's it like?" I said, "I don't know what they're telling you, but it's terrible over there." And he welcomed me home, and that was the first part of my welcome home.
Vaughn, the Vietnamese Association of Illinois, located in sometimes what's called Asia on Argyle or Little Saigon in Chicago's Edgewater, uptown-ish mm-hmm. communities, why is this neighborhood so important to keeping the history and culture of Vietnam alive in Chicago?
Yeah, I think as Mom mentioned, you know, a lot of the Vietnamese refugees when they first came resettled on Argyle. And so, you know, took it as an opportunity to rebuild that neighborhood. And I think people share stories about what it was like in the 70s and 80s, just a very, you know, divested community with, yeah, a lot of violence and under-resourced communities. And for that, for, you know, Vietnamese refugees who had to rebuild to come into an area like that, and, you know, rebuild with essentially nothing, building, you know, network of mutual aid and community support for each other to be able to seek affordable housing, to be able to seek, you know, the services that they need. You know, I can imagine that folks who, you know, didn't speak English, for example, you know, some folks were educated, others were not. And so to be able to connect them with the resources that were available in Chicago and to be able to build this thriving community that we see today, I think that's, you know, a huge milestone for the community.
This Saturday, the organization, you all are hosting a 50 years of Vietnamese American community building event. Briefly tell us what folks can expect there.
Yeah, so this is an opportunity for us to commemorate the 50th anniversary since the fall of Saigon, and then also to celebrate, you know, what the community has been able to build in the last 50 years. You know, you mentioned that Vietnam right now is doing a celebration of reunification, and I think that's not a narrative that we share amongst Vietnamese Americans. You know, it's a very difficult history. I think people often frame it as them losing their country, right, like losing the fight, you know, for democracy, which I think is a cause that a lot of people have believed in and to fight for. So this event itself is to be able to commemorate all of the aspects of the Vietnamese American community. So to represent the experiences of Vietnamese refugees, but also the families that have come since then, and also the perspective of young people. You know, I think to hear Roger's experience from it, I think that's a history that not a lot of young people are even aware of. And so we have, you know, veterans that are doing a color march, and then also interfaith service prayer for obviously the millions of lives that were lost during the war.
Roger, I know that you hold weekly meetings every Tuesday morning for 100 or so Vietnam veterans. So obviously you're keeping that conversation going. Before we run out of time, though, I want to know what it means to you when you look back at a war that was 50 years ago that you were a part of.
It's when the fall of Saigon came in 75. It was very disturbing to a lot of us because we had fought there and tried to get freedom for the South Vietnamese people, and it didn't work out. So I reflected an awful lot on that. And then I didn't do anything, never talked about Vietnam. I came home from work one time, was a manager for the phone company. I told my wife I'm going to D.C. to the wall. There's 21 guys on the wall that I served with. There's 10 from my parish right here in the northwest side that were killed in Vietnam. So there was a lot of input after that, and then I got involved, and then three of us started to have coffee, and it started from there. We had one of our veterans had cards made.
Something that was, it sounds like it was once upon a time very difficult to talk about, and that you all are slowly able to do that. Hmong, I'm going to give you the last word, almost out of time. What does it mean to you to look back on that day that you were evacuated from Vietnam 50 years ago?
It really mean really very difficult for me to think back because it happened, so many people die young, and But a good thing when I think about we were so lucky to get to U.S. This is the free country. We work and we can live with it. At okay. Very, very,
we'll leave it there.
You know,
yeah.
This well, is the life that.
We're glad that you're here. Thank you for your service.
Yeah.
Thanks to all of you for joining us. Our thanks to Roger McGill, Dale Tippett, Meng Wan, and Von Nguyen. Up next, how Chicago got its sanctuary city status and what it means. President Trump this week upped the ante in his ongoing battle against sanctuary cities like Chicago. Trump signed an executive order demanding the Justice Department and Homeland Security publish a list of state and local jurisdictions that have declined to cooperate with the administration's immigration crackdown. The next step could be an attempt to cut off certain federal funds to sanctuary cities. But what exactly is a sanctuary city? And how did Chicago become one? That's the timely subject of tonight's edition of WTTW News Explains with Joanna Hernandez.
For four decades, Chicago has held the designation of a sanctuary city. But what does it mean, and how has Chicago's status endured? The term sanctuary city refers to any jurisdiction that discourages, limits, or denies cooperation with federal immigration authorities. There are currently hundreds of sanctuary communities in America and 13 sanctuary states. Where do they come from? Well, Berkeley, California claimed the title of first sanctuary city in 1971, the sanctuary city movement really began popping up across the country in the mid-1980s. As President Reagan focused on identifying and deporting undocumented immigrants, churches opened their doors to provide shelter and resources for Central Americans fleeing civil war and violence. In Chicago, becoming and remaining a sanctuary city has been a bit of a mayoral tug of war. Mayor Harold Washington first declared Chicago a sanctuary city in 1985 via executive order. The order prohibited police and city employees from questioning residents about their immigration status and terminated cooperation with federal immigration authorities. Some argued the policy shielded convicted criminals from deportation. And in the 1990s, Mayor Richard M. Daley interpreted the policy to allow city officials to provide immigration information to the feds if the subjects were involved in serious crimes. Chicago's sanctuary policies went from executive order to a strong law with the 2006 Welcoming City Ordinance. In 2012, Mayor Rahm Emanuel and the City Council weakened the law, allowing police to work with federal officials in limited cases. Upon election in 2016, President Donald Trump threatened sanctuary cities with the loss of federal dollars. Nevertheless, the Chicago City Council voted to reaffirm the ordinance. Under Mayor Lori Lightfoot, an expanded welcoming ordinance closed the loopholes opened by Daley and Emanuel, banning all police cooperation with federal immigration authorities. As Chicago enters its 40th year as a sanctuary city, Mayor Brandon Johnson has reaffirmed Chicago's commitment. And today, thousands of refugees and undocumented immigrants have found a safe haven in Chicago. A point of pride for those who believe offering sanctuary is a matter of human rights. And a point of consternation for those who see it as a hurdle for law enforcement.
You can watch more of our WTTW News Explained series on our website. That is at WTTW.com/explains. Chicago's Cinco de Mayo parade has been put on pause this year. Organizers say it was canceled because of fears over President Donald Trump's immigration crackdown. They say nearly half of the parade sponsors dropped out after the city became a major target for immigration enforcement agents. Here with more on this are Hector Escobar, president of Casa Puebla and the Cermak Road Chamber of Commerce, And on Zoom, 25th Ward Alderman Byron Sigcho Lopez, who represents areas like Pilsen and Little Village. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Brenda.
Hector, let's start with you, please. Some people confuse Cinco de Mayo with Mexican Independence Day, but tell us what Cinco de Mayo really celebrates.
Well, Cinco de Mayo is really for us Poblanos. We won the battle against the French in 1862. And basically that battle took place in a part in Puebla, Mexico. The French came through Veracruz, to the port of Veracruz, because it was money which owed to French, the French time at that point. So they tried to take over the country because that amount of money. So, but fortunately, it was a great general, Ignacio Zaragoza. It was Mexican-American. He was born in the States, and he took over and lead to win that battle in Puebla, Mexico.
Alderman, how have your constituents responded to the announcement that the parade is being canceled this year?
Well, I think, of course, is any tradition that it gets compromised because the violence that the federal government has unleashed, federal resources is carrying our community. It is really a call for action. Really, we see President Trump is really a disaster. It comes about the economics of our community. We've seen the decline, that people are afraid of going to school, going to their homes, going to events. But I think that little by little, I think the community has started to overcome the fear. We cannot be afraid of dictators. We have to organize. So it was great to see a great May Day action. Dozens and thousands of people who came out in Little Village, just being, you know, a few weeks after the inauguration, more people coming out, and there was a march of over 3,000 people. So, of course, we're going to respond to the fear, to the dehumanization, the criminalization, with more organizing, and we are not going to be afraid.
And I know you participated in that May Day action today as well. Hector, the parade has taken place in the city for over 40 years. How has it evolved over time?
Well, actually, it's been great, except last year we had an issue with the gang problem, but, you know, it was solved. Thanks to Alderman Byron and the police department, they've been great. Any sources, anything we need, is they're being helping all the time. And people are proud, very proud to take and be participating in the Cinco de Mayo. And especially us as Mexicans, and it's a good time to celebrate and show a culture. But at this point, there's nothing to celebrate. It is just hard, like the Alderman says. People are afraid. Some people, they don't want to go to work. They had to go to work because one of them had to provide, but one of them had to stay home.
Are there fears that other events might need to be canceled as well, like Mexican Independence Day?
Well, I hope not, but you know what? Everyone has to take a decision. We took our decision. We consult around the neighborhood, and that was best for the community to keep them safe. And we saw some great turn today, May 1st. Yeah, I hope everything turns like that way, but that's different to celebrate. We had to celebrate our culture.
Alderman, what do communities lose when these celebrations don't happen, both economically for the businesses that benefit from celebrations like this, but also like the loss of a cultural exchange?
Yeah, I think that this is a loss in all fronts. Like you mentioned, we've seen the decline of economic activity on very vital and you know, vibrant areas like 26th Street, 18th Street. So we see like not only the economic loss, but like you said, the attack on the identity, the culture, the vibrancy of our neighborhoods. So it is really an attack on communities to spread fear, hate, dehumanization, criminalization, but ultimately to really attack our city, which is really at stake. And that's for people to come together to help.
Hector, okay. Sorry, Alderman, you're freezing a little bit, so I'm going to ask Hector. Hector, some members of the community, I understand, are planning to leave the U.S. amid this immigration crackdown. What can you tell us about that?
Well, you know, since we have seen these raids all over the country, in my home state, the governor of Puebla, Alejandro Armenta, is going to open an office here in Pilsen, matter of fact. And they're helping them to get some of them some documents they cannot obtain through the Mexican consulate. And also because they're preparing, the governor, they're preparing to help them in case they want to move back to Mexico with jobs, with monies to start a business. And they are very serious to move back to Mexico, a lot of people.
So rather than staying here, some folks are considering, and living in sort of that fear, some folks are considering just picking up and heading back to Mexico altogether.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yes.
That's where we'll have to leave it. Alderman, I know we've got you, and sorry about that, but thank you so much to Alderman Byron Sigcho Lopez for joining us, as well as Hector Escobar.
Good to see you, Alderman.
And that is our show for this Thursday night. Join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 7 for the Week in Review. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thanks for watching. Have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that supports educational initiatives in the legal profession.